I'm Gary Nall, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, we'll be continuing with our Conversations with Remarkable Minds series. The theme, the new economic hitmen and the new sophistication of economic aggression. My guest is John Perkins. For many years, primarily through the 1970s and 80s, John Perkins was an economic hitman, a job to convince leaders of developing nations to accept economic conditions that benefit the United States' private and government interest. Now, he was a direct participant or witness to such dramatic modern events as the Saudi Arabian money laundering scandal, the fall of the Shah of Iran, the assassinations of Ecuador and Panama's democratically elected presidents, and other governments and corporate intrigues. John was a chief economist for a range of international consulting firms advising the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund and the UN. He also consulted with Fortune 500 companies and many national governments. But since leaving his covert activities, John has been a champion of indigenous spiritual cultures and environmental movements throughout the world and through his nonprofit projects, Dream Change, which has hosted educational events to help raise consciousness and inspire more sustainable ways of living. And also after 9/11, John broke his silence with the publication of his international bestseller that has just been fully revised and published as The New Confessions of an Economic Hitman. And that is to explain that rather than a corrupt specialized activity among select consulting and international construction firms in the past, the system of economic hitmen has rather become more sophisticated and more devious and more widespread, and even through the halls of government, and is now intentionally bankrupting the U.S. as it has done in the past with developing nations. His website is johnperkins.org and dreamchange.org. Nice to have you with us today, John.
Thanks, Gary. It's great to be with you again.
John, several years ago, you were on the program to share your past experience as an executive economic and international hitman for a private consulting group to advance the principles of disaster capitalism in poor developing nations. This was to make these nations' leaders obedient to free market capitalism, privatization of their resources to large Western multinational corporations and interests, and to increase U.S. government's imperial outreach. Now you are saying that this system of economic hitmen is far more sophisticated, it's widespread, it's catastrophic more than ever before. So before we look at how this system has transformed throughout the United States government, the Congress, and become embedded in private corporations and the financial system, please briefly summarize first economic hitmen and the system's primary mission and long-term agendas in the past and today. And like, for the example, we had at one time the Dulles brothers. Dulles, one was Secretary of State, the other was head of the CIA, but they worked together. And they had come from a consortium of some of the most powerful men in the world, like the Rockefellers and the Morgans. They represented their interests. They managed their money. So when they did something, it was always with the idea that they were going to put pressure upon a government, politicians and rulers of a government, to do the bidding of these corporations, or they could get assassinated. So that was before you. Now, that was in the 1930s and 40s and 50s and 60s. Now they have new people. So we're going to take a look at how all this has evolved. And then I also want you to take a look at what is their main motive, and then explain the strategy the U.S. has followed for decades through the multilateral agencies like the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank to keep countries straitjacketed in huge debt as a means of to colonize these nations' governments and economies. And finally, how has this changed and become more sophisticated? The form is yours. Take your time.
Well, thanks, Gary. Yeah, you may have to step in and remind me where I'm going with all this. But to start with, so in my day, which was basically the 1970s, I was chief economist at Charles T. Maine, which was a a very influential consulting firm, but also very low key. We totally avoided the press. We're about 2,000 people working for the company, of which about 5% of us were the owners, partners. And we assiduously avoided publicity. We did a lot of work behind the scenes. We were usually paid by the World Bank, USAID, the U.S. Treasury Department, and such organizations as that. And really, my job was to identify countries that have resources that our corporations wanted, like oil or other resources. Sometimes it would be labor, cheap labor, and to arrange huge loans to those countries through the World Bank or one of its sister organizations or USAID and other, and sometimes Wall Street. The money wouldn't actually go to the countries. It would be transferred from the World Bank or one of the other banks directly to a company like Bechtel or Halliburton or Brown and Root or Stone and Webster or my own company, Charles T. Maine. And we would be, the country would sign off on the loan. So they would be responsible. The asset that we wanted, such as oil, often still in the ground, was used as, was considered the collateral. They would sign off on the loan. They owed the money, but they never saw the money. The money went directly to our corporations to build big infrastructure projects in those countries, things like electric power systems, highways, ports, industrial parks, things that benefited a few wealthy families in those countries, and therefore made it showed statistically that there was tremendous economic growth. When these wealthy families who owned the industries used the highways, used the electricity, used the infrastructure that was built, the economies did increase, statistically speaking. And that's what I've been taught in business school, was the way that you help developing countries develop. And it statistically looks very good. But what I discovered as I got deeper into this was that, in fact, the poor people were suffering in these countries. Money was being diverted from education and healthcare and other social services to pay off the interest on the loans. Our companies were making huge profits. The wealthy people who owned the industries were doing very well. The economy looked like it was doing well, but the majority of the people were not doing well. And it took a while for me to totally understand that. Once I did, it's when I finally eventually got out. But in the meantime, the leaders of these countries also realized that if they didn't play this game, then what we call the jackals would very likely come along and overthrow them or assassinate them. And they had a lot of examples they could fall back on. They'd seen this happen to Mossadegh in Iran. That was under the Dulles brothers, who you mentioned. I'll talk a little bit more about that later. And in the Mossadegh of Iran, Arbenz of Guatemala, Allende of Chile, Lumumba of the Congo, Diem of Vietnam, these are heads of states. And there are a lot of other examples of ministers of finance, ministers of the economy, other people a little lower down that suffered similar consequences. So there was a tremendous pressure on these leaders, knowing that if they accepted the money, probably they and their families, who were the wealthy people, would do very well. And if they didn't accept the money, they would be out. They were very likely that they would be taken out in one way or another. And so the system, you know, continued, and it was very effective. At some point, we would go back and say to the country, well, since you can't pay your debts, because in the end, they couldn't pay the principal. They were striving to pay the interest on the loans all along, to, as I said, diverting money from other needed things in their countries to pay the interest. But in the end, they usually couldn't pay the principal. So we'd go back and say, since you can't pay off your debts, sell your resource, oil or whatever, real cheap to our corporations without any environmental or social regulations. Or allow us to build a military base on your soil, as we did in places like Ecuador and Colombia and other places, or vote with us on the next United Nations vote, as we did throughout the Americas against Castro, for example, at the United Nations. So it really was the creation of this form of empire through debt and so forth. And I will say, you know, as we look back in the long run, we can see that there's been progress in many of these countries, that some of these systems in the long run have helped people lead better lives in many respects. We see starvation around the world as a percentage of population at least going down. But the immediate result was that it was extremely beneficial to our corporations and a few wealthy families, and a lot of other people suffered in the immediate, and then the immediate would be a decade or more before they might start to see some benefits from this system. And really, as you mentioned, the Dulles brothers, it really began with them. So John Foster and Alan Dulles were Secretary of State and head of the CIA under Eisenhower. And there was a Prime Minister of Iran named Mossadegh, and he ran on a Democratic election on a platform that said that he would make sure that the oil company that was working there, which was a British company, became British Petroleum and eventually BP, would, he said, if he became president, they would have to pay a percentage. They'd have to pay the Iranian people essentially a tax. They'd have to pay for a share of the profits they made off the oil, something that seemed pretty reasonable. And he won, to everybody's surprise. So the British were very upset. They didn't have a relationship with Iran. The United States did, a diplomatic relationship. They asked Eisenhower to do something. Well, Eisenhower was terrified of nuclear war. You know, he was a soldier, he'd been a top general during World War II. And the Russians were right on the border of Iran. They had nuclear weapons, the Soviet Union at that time. We had nuclear weapons, and Eisenhower was very afraid of stimulating an event that would cause global destruction, nuclear war. So he did not want to go in there and do anything that would get the Russians to, you know, push the button, so to speak. The Dulles brothers came up with this idea, and they said, well, let's send a CIA agent in and see what we can do. So they identified Kermit Roosevelt, who was Teddy Roosevelt's grandson. He was a CIA agent. He literally carried suitcases full of money into Iran, and he used the money to convince, to corrupt police officers and military people, and also to hire a lot of poor people, people on the street. He paid them to demonstrate against Mossadegh. And he made it look as though this prime minister was very unpopular, which by all the information I've ever had was totally wrong. But he did a very good job, and he bought press, he bought reporters, and make a long story short, it was very successful. Mossadegh was overthrown, put under house arrest for the rest of his life, and the Shah, who had been waiting in the wings, whose father had one time been Shah of Iran, the Shah was waiting in the wings in Syria and Iraq and other parts of the Middle East. He was flown in by the CIA and took over the country. It was an amazingly successful operation. No bloodshed, essentially, and there were some riots, a few people hurt. But there was no war. There was no threat of war. And it was done very cheaply, a few million dollars in those suitcases. And so at that point, the Dulles brothers and Eisenhower and everybody else in the establishment decided, well, this is a great way to go. Let's get people like Kermit Roosevelt. Let's get more of those guys out there. We can do this in other countries. The problem was that Roosevelt was a card-carrying CIA agent, and if he'd been caught, the U.S. government would have been embarrassed, to say the least. So the decision at that point was made to hire outside consultants, what the CIA refers to not as employees but as assets, and I became one of those, essentially. So this work was done. It wasn't often the CIA had never even paid anybody. The payments came through the Treasury Department or the State Department or USAID or World Bank or some such organization. But basically, our job was to do what, as I've described before, which was really set up by Kermit Roosevelt. And it was extremely successful. And so it really, for many years, so I came onto the scene just as the Vietnam War was winding down. It was obvious that we'd lost, that our military operations were not successful. And so for many years, until 9/11, this system was the system, the preeminent system for spreading what I call the corporatocracy. It's an empire. It's not really an American empire. It's a corporate empire. These corporations are not particularly loyal to America. They don't want to pay taxes. They don't necessarily hire Americans. but it is a it's a big corporate global empire, and it was very successfully executed in this way. And it is true that the Dulles brothers were the architects of something that continued for many, many years very, very successfully. And as I say, until 9/11, and it still continued after 9/11. But what happened in 9/11, prior to 9/11, the military, what Eisenhower referred to as the military-industrial complex, the people who make weapons, they were suffering. So although other industries were expanding, it's particularly engineering and technological industries that were building the infrastructure projects, the kind of companies like I worked for, and including companies like General Electric and General Dynamics and the companies that make the technical equipment, they were doing really well. But the military side was not doing well, and they were putting pressure on presidents, including Clinton and others, to somehow get the military back involved. 9/11 happened, and it was the perfect opportunity for President Bush to declare, well, not really declare war, but to instigate a war. And so since then, we've had this very interesting situation where we've got economic hitmen still doing their stuff, but we've also got the military going into many places, the Middle East and Afghanistan and, well, Yemen, you know the name. So since 9/11, we've had these two parallel courses that are working simultaneously toward the same end. So I think maybe I should turn this over to you to see where you want to go next.
Well, it seems to me, when we look back at history, the big players behind the deep state's regime changes and manipulation of foreign governments were more sophisticated than the people on Wall Street or the oligarchical executives today. And certainly today the methods used are more sophisticated. But when I think of the Dulles brothers that you just mentioned, or even Henry Kissinger or Brzezinski, who just died a few months ago, these were academically and politically savvy players who had an understanding of history. Today, the oligarchy calls the shots are a little more than powerful, wealthy entrepreneurs. And most, in my estimation, are simply clueless about the lessons to be learned from history. Trump's cabinet is an excellent example of the complete lack of critical thinking. None are intellects. In fact, very few people successful in business today are true intellects. I have the good fortune of counseling and helping a lot of people with the health issues in their life. I've counseled thousands of very powerful people, including some very wealthy people. And when I get into a general conversation of their views on things, there's no depth there. And that would not have been the same case. I remember when I first came to New York City, I loved to hang out at a place called the New Yorker Bookstore, also downtown, a place called the Strand Bookstore. But the New Yorker was at 89th and Broadway. There was a movie theater downstairs that played really good art films. And upstairs, there was just this very cluttered but comfortable, had couches and well-worn couches and armchairs you could sit and read if you didn't want to buy the book or couldn't afford to. And there'd always be interesting dialogue, debates, and discussions going on about the body politic. And some of the critical thinkers of that time hung out there in the evenings. And I lived just down the street. I lived on 89th Street between Riverside and West End in a small little apartment. So that was my enjoyment for the evening. Today, you don't have those type of places to hang out. Everything's on the internet. There's so much bias. There's so much conditioning. There's so much filtering before a person can make their own decisions. And rarely do we do real scholarship today. And part, you don't have to, because everyone has synthesized what you're supposed to know into short little think bites. So you want to know about Moby Dick, you don't have to read Moby Dick, Herman Melville's book. You just get a two-page synopsis, and then somehow you're supposed to know the meaning of it and the deeper understanding of it. It's not true. So we have these very superficial intellects today. And I have found that the people who are very successful in corporate America and in government, business, are very superficial. They do not understand geopolitics, and they regard other nations and populations solely as pawns on a chessboard to be moved for their personal advantage, and there's nothing humanitarian in their motives. Do you agree with this assessment? And if not, please lay out your reasons not to. And how does this make our economic policies and actions even more egregious towards other countries, especially developing nations?
Yeah, well, I certainly agree with the dumbing down. There's been a tremendous dumbing down in general, in America at least. And, you know, we're seeing that through the current administration, where everything is policy is set by tweets. It's amazing. That's also happening in India with Prime Minister Modi. He does everything by tweets, and it's becoming more popular around the world. I was just with Prime Minister Modi, incidentally, in St. Petersburg, Russia, the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum, and President Putin was speaking there. Modi was speaking there. Secretary General Guterres of the UN was speaking there. I was speaking. There were a lot of amazing people speaking there. But at the same time that we see this massive dumbing down, and we see how incredibly susceptible we are to the media, which has also been dumbed down, you know, we've gone from the hot half-hour nightly news that I think really tried to be pretty objective for the most part, and you could compete between NBC, CBS, and ABC. We've gone from that to constant news on Fox and CNN and other places, and they're having to create stories to fill the time, and they're also being very sensational so that people will watch them. There's a huge dumbing down. At the same time, I am seeing, as I travel around, I do a lot of speaking. I travel, you know, something like 10 out of 12 months a year speaking. I find that people are waking up around the world, too. Earlier this morning, I was on a Skype. I gave a Skype lecture to a university in Minnesota. And those students there, they're really into this. They're waking up. They're understanding. So there's two forces at play here. There's the dumbing down of the general public and the media that's doing that, but there's also, I think, an awakening on another level where these young people, you don't have to tell them there's global warming. They don't fall for the idea that that's ridiculous. They believe that the glaciers are melting and the oceans are rising and species are going extinct. They know that three individuals have as much wealth in the United States as half the U.S. population, and that eight individuals globally have as much wealth as half the global population, and they know that's not good. So there are those two forces at work, and I think we're in a very critical time. We've seen that in Brexit, you know, the two forces, the opposing forces. We saw that in the presidential election here. We had Sanders on the what we might call the far left. I kind of hate these labels, but very progressive, socialistic type of people appealed to them. And on the far right, we had Trump, and in the middle, we had Hillary. But the fact we had these two extremes in Sanders and Trump was representative of things that are going on around the world today. Brexit is another great example of how that's happening. So we're at this time of extremes. And I think there's a consciousness revolution struggling to emerge, an awakening to the fact that this system, what I call a death economy, a global system that's given us great rewards over the past, incredible science, technology, medicine, art, literature, music, incredible things over the past, but it's gone too far. And people don't really like change. We don't want to see that drastic change, and yet there is an awakening around the world that system has gone too far and it's no longer working. We can't keep extracting. We can't keep polluting. We can't keep growing a monetary-type economy. We've got to move in another direction, what I call a life economy, which is cleaning up pollution and regenerating destroyed environments and recycling and new technologies that draw on the sun and wind and so forth. We need to move much faster in that direction, but there's a resistance there. And, you know, Gary, it's interesting. So at the St. Petersburg Economic Forum, when President Putin spoke, it was, to me, very interesting. Now, I want to start by saying I have no doubt that this man has done some pretty bad things. He's suppressed dissent in his country. He's controlled the press to a large degree. There's been a tremendous amount of corruption under him. Who knows what else he's done? But I also understand that perception is a huge thing. Human reality is molded by the way we perceive it. And at that conference, one of the things he said that really struck me was he said he was asked if the United States, if he controlled the United States election, he said, well, does Russia spy on the United States? Do we want to have some influence there? Yes. Does the United States spy on Russia and want to have some influence here? Yes. But he said, I wish I could control the U.S. elections. But he said, I don't have that power. But he said, in any case, that's the old Cold War mentality. And these are Putin himself, and I'm paraphrasing, but he said there's five real problems that we've all got to deal with. Chinese, Russians, Brazilians, Indians, Americans, everybody. We've got to deal with climate change. We've got to deal with global income inequality. We've got to deal with the potential for nuclear holocaust, for cybersecurity and terrorism, those five things. And he said, we've all got to come together to deal with that. Now, again, I'm not trying to hold Putin out to be, you know, the greatest. He's done a lot of bad things. But the fact is, he is seeing that there has to be a new perception in the world. And I heard that also from Guterres, the Secretary General of the United Nations, something similar, and from Modi of India. And so there is this awakening around the world that we've got some very serious problems that we all have to come together and deal with and create a new type of global system, which I call a life economy. It's not just an economic system, though. It's social, political, legal, environmental, and economic. We need to move in that direction.
Let me intercede here for a moment. All of these major leaders of countries, including Modi in India, he is more aligned with theocracy. And there's great racial, or there's great spiritual strife in India. That is also true in Myanmar. It is also true in many of the old nations aligned, countries aligned with the former Soviet Empire. But here's one thing Putin did do that I would support. In the period of our leading up to our regime change in Syria, we said that Assad was guilty of all these crimes against humanity. And yet, independent journalists who've gone there, and we've had them on this program, at least four, said it wasn't true. The people of Syria, the vast majority of people of Syria, were disappointed in the fact that they had had year after year of drought, but that wasn't Assad's fault. That was occurring because at one point, Syria was the breadbasket of the Middle East. And after four straight years of severe drought, farmers could no longer sustain being on the farm. They didn't have the water. And so they moved into the cities. And the cities became strapped for cash because they had all these social programs, free education. All you had to buy were your books for like $40 a year. But your education was free, medicine was free, and there was very low crime. It didn't mean that Assad was a great person. It meant that if you looked in totality, he wasn't the demon we had made him out to be. There are a lot worse people in the world and a lot worse countries. I could name United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, certainly, Bahrain, and Yemen that had done more against their people than Assad had. But not once in 14 months did you hear a single comment about the United States' military and our intelligence agencies blowing up the oil tankers going from Turkey and Iraq into Syria, stealing its oil, then going back into Turkey and selling it on the black market for as low as $20 a barrel. That was well established. In fact, I read the verbatim comments of a former top person in Turkish intelligence who discussed this in depth. He then became an enemy of the state, and they tried to go after him. But he was there. He was at the top, so he saw all this. Other people would do the same. So it was Turkey and Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates and France and Great Britain and Italy that were all involved along with the United States. So if you have 12,000 tankers taking full of oil going over the border, then back across the border, you'd have to know that. You would know if there was one tanker truck, let alone 12,000. We didn't stop the supply. And that's where money was going to support ISIS, al-Nusra, al-Qaeda in Syria. Not at once did we bomb those. So that should have been a big red flag. Also, at the hearings on Benghazi, the question that was lied about was, why were we at that embassy? Why did we still keep it open when it was so volatile? It was because we had taken Gaddafi's weapons, which were, he had a large stockpile of weapons, and we were transporting them through Benghazi into Syria to fight against Assad. So that broke international laws. So if Hillary Clinton and the CIA and the national security agencies and the Department of Defense had to acknowledge, yes, we were breaking international laws, well, who exactly were these weapons going to? Where they were going to our terrorists, the friendly terrorists? No, same group of people beheading. So we would have been shown to be complicit in supporting terrorism, as was Saudi Arabia. We know all this. This was in the emails. In comes Putin, and he bombs all those 12,000 tankers, and then he goes after them. Now, we get angry because the United States says he's bombing our terrorists, and we want our terrorists to win. You mean the ones that were beheading people in mass killings? Yes. The Free Syrian Army? Yes. So if he did nothing else except save Syria, along with Hezbollah and Iran, then that would be noteworthy, because imagine today what Libya is like. It's a completely failed state. It went from being the number one country, number one in all of Africa, 54 countries. It went to be number one in education, number one in longevity, number one in freedom of women in a Muslim country, number one in free health care. And it was called the Paris of Africa, to dead last, because now there are over 200 different terrorist groups, each grabbing certain parts of the country. It's a complete wasteland. And then from there, you had Mali and other countries where they're using it as routes in from Africa into the Middle East to fight. These are terrorists. So Syria would have gone the same way. The Syrian people would have had, if Assad had been forced out or assassinated, if the no-fly zone had gone into effect that McCain, a warmonger, and Hillary Clinton, a super warmonger, had wanted, then it would have been over very quickly. And all this false campaign against him would have been kept in permanent place. But Russia kept that from happening. Now we're going into the cities that have been captured from ISIS, and the people are telling, like in East Aleppo versus West Aleppo, what it was really like about the fraud of the White Helmets. They're really a terrorist organization that we spend hundreds of millions of dollars. Our money went to a terrorist organization. They won an Academy Award. All lies, all propaganda. Everything we've been told about Syria was lies and propaganda. But that's the one thing, even if you don't agree with anything else, that Putin should get credit for, and that's the media and our government has never given him credit for saving the Syrian people from what would have been a proxy government, taking over, terrorists running it, Saudi Arabia supporting it, and that's where we're at. Your thoughts on that, please.
Well, you know, what you're discussing, Gary, is the story behind the story, and that's what, you know, my book is about, The New Confessions of an Economic Hitman, goes into that in even more detail than the original confessions. That there are always these stories behind the story of empire building. And also, I think in Syria, Putin at one point saved Obama's butt. Obama was put in a very difficult position. Putin stepped in and pulled him out. But the fact of the matter is, there's always these stories behind the story. And yes, I agree with you. I was just at a conference with a man from Iraq. And he was saying, you know, Iraq wasn't a bad place under Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein was not a great, he certainly wasn't a Democrat in the small d, but he ran a pretty good country. And now the place, as this guy said, is an absolute living hellhole. And you can say the same for Libya. It's happening in Syria. It's happening in Yemen. It's a different situation, but something kind of similar that you described happened in Venezuela. In the 50s and 60s, the wealthiest country in Latin America, the highest income per capita and so forth. And because of oil and there's a lot of factors there, it's now the worst off country in Latin America. We can see this meddling. And, you know, empire building has always created havoc. And one of the ways that empires succeed and maintain control is by creating havoc and making the situation difficult. And there's nothing like a war to generate income. So the United States economy, as we all know, is very strongly dependent upon the defense industry and all the other industries around there. And then, you know, they're already talking, Secretary of State Tillerson is already talking about how we need to start spending a lot of money to rebuild Iraq and Syria and Afghanistan. And of course, that creates another whole set of income. And we are dumbed down in America. Where there's no question. We're fed a lot of propaganda. The Russians are fed a lot of propaganda, too, the opposite side. And the Chinese, everybody's being fed this propaganda. And it's great that there's there's media like you that gets this message out. And I think they're kind of increasing. And what I found interesting recently is how Hollywood has bought into this. And incidentally, the TV series based on Confessions of an Economic Hitman will probably be out within the next year, maybe a little longer. I'm very excited about that. But just recently, I just recently went to the movie Mark Felt, which was about Deep Throat, you know, the second in command at the FBI during the time of Watergate. The Viceroy's House, which is this true story of how Lord Mountbatten was deceived into helping split India and Pakistan because the British wanted that split to happen. And The American Maid with Tom Cruise was based on a true story of the CIA, of a CIA asset who was a pilot in Colombia and throughout Central America. So these movies, now Hollywood is getting into this. So the information more and more is getting out there. And I hope it continues. I hope it gets much more so. We need transparency. The story behind the story needs to emerge.
If there was one positive effect that Trump presidency has had, it has been the chaos we're witnessing. More and more people are realizing that Washington has been controlled and run by straw men, and both parties are imploding. Even if Democrats had won the recent election, their party remains extremely unpopular. And what progressives have been saying for years, that the government is run by oligarchs, is no longer considered not supportable. It's very clear. My question is whether or not you see the economic hitman agenda still in place in the White House, or has something changed? And also, people are eager to know who is actually calling the shots today. From your best vantage point, who are the puppet masters and who are the puppets to bring into the public spotlight?
Stepping back a bit to looking at the current administration, I agree with you. I think one of the things, a great gift that Trump has given us, is to expose the shadow. And that certainly happened. We know that under Bush, under Clinton, under Obama, we had people in very high positions that came out of Wall Street that represented the interests of Wall Street and the big corporations. That was obvious if you look. But under Trump, it's become really obvious, become totally overt. And he's one of them. Yeah, he's personally making a lot of money. We can rail against Putin for being corrupt, but our own White House, there's no question that under any moral standard, whether it's legal or not, I can't say. I'm not a lawyer, but certainly under any moral standard, there's horrible corruption being committed under this administration, promoting golf courses and, I mean, the overt and casinos and hotels and the businesses of his children and so on. Trump has brought out the shadow, and for that we need to thank him. Are there still economic hitmen in the White House? Well, yes. And I think the other thing for us to all recognize is that in my day, we economic hitmen were pretty generic. So my job was to get these huge loans, get countries to be indebted to us, and have the money come back to U.S. corporations. It really wasn't terribly important to me which companies in the United States get the contracts. I didn't really care whether Bechtel got it or Halliburton got it or Brown & Root or Stone & Webster. I hoped that my own company would continue to get parts of it. We got fairly small parts because we were consultant. We weren't another construction company. But I didn't really care which big companies got it. Today, we've still got those people working for organizations like AID and the World Bank or consultants to those organizations. But in addition, every major corporation has its own version of economic hitmen. The Walmarts, the Chevrons, the Nikes, the Monsantos, they all have their version of economic hitmen out there lobbying countries, even lobbying cities in the United States to compete against each other to where they're going to locate the next plant. Right now, I live near Seattle, and one of our homegrown companies here, Amazon, is out, you know, lobbying with various locations to see where they're going to put their next plant and or the next offices and employ a lot of people. They're trying to get more tax breaks. We do this. These economic hitmen who are working for Amazon are out there lobbying and trying to get tax breaks and trying to get minimum wages lowered and so forth. They do it within our own country, but they also do it country against country. So it's become much more prevalent. In addition to that, we've got them working with our students, you know, getting our students deep into debt. I can't tell you, Gary, how many students I talk to that have just graduated from or about to graduate from law school or business school, and they tell me, you know, I went to the school because I really wanted to do something good. I wanted to create a business, or I wanted to be a lawyer that works with poor people and does good things in the world, environmental things or socially responsible things. But I'm getting out of school with $200,000 worth of debt. And so I'm going to have to go to work for a big corporation to pay off that debt. But in 5 years, I'll have it paid off, and then I'll be able to do what I want to do. But I know that the probability is that they will now take more debt to get a house. They'll may get married and have children, and they'll have to start planning for college. They'll buy cars. They'll get deeper and deeper into debt. That's the chances are, because they've been predisposed to that. That's part of their education. Keep taking on this debt, and that's another form of this economic hitman thing. So there's a lot of sort of the shadowy side of the economic hitman that's going on big time. And my hope is that enough of us are getting it, and that Trump is helping us get it, that we will be able to recognize that and move beyond it. And I'm glad you're talking about it.
Africa seems to be one of the new economic battlefields. Years ago, there was no separate U.S. military command assigned to the African continent. Now there is. And China is making enormous efforts to position itself in African nations too, but not militarily, as the U.S. is. How do you interpret the U.S. interest in Africa, especially with our efforts to increase our military presence there, when at the same time, China is allocating between $2 to $3 trillion and has aligned with 67 nations to build a new Silk Road? They're building bridges and docks and terminals and high-speed trains and economic communities. And the United States is building drone bases.
Yeah. Well, I think that the United States is making a very big strategic mistake. After Russia, I went to Kazakhstan, where there's another economic forum, and Putin also went there, and so did Guterres and Modi. And I became good friends. I spent a lot of time talking to one of Putin's top economic advisors. A guy has written a book in English. He'd read Confessions, he told me, in English, loved it, then bought it in Russian and read it there. And he says Putin's read it too. And one of the things that he pointed out, he said that he thinks that China has learned from our mistakes and the mistakes made by Russia and the Soviet Union. And one of those mistakes was all the military intervention. I travel in Latin America. I speak Spanish fluently. I know some people in very high positions in Latin America, and they'll tell me they'd much rather borrow from China than the United States or any of our affiliated organizations like the World Bank, because they say China's never put a military base on their soil. They've never overthrown or assassinated a leader, as far as they know, and we have. And I'll say to them, well, don't you think China's got the same goal of stealing your resources? And they say, well, maybe, but they haven't done the nefarious things that the United States has done in the past. We know the United States has done these things. And the fact that we're continuing to build military bases and have drones and this presence in Africa, I believe, is a huge, huge strategic error. Yes, the Chinese are going in there full blown, and I have no doubt that their motives are very similar to ours. They're empire builders too. They want those resources, but they're outmaneuvering us, because people hate to have military presence on their soil. We hated it in the United States when the British were here, and everybody hates it. And the fact that we've got this, and innocent civilians are being killed by these drones, is just really upsetting people. It's angering them against us. And I hear people that don't like the fact that the Chinese come in and they bring their own workers and they make you buy all the equipment from China and so on and so forth. They resent that. But They like the fact that the Chinese do not have a military presence. It's not a thumb in their face. It's not a thorn in their side the way that our strategies have been. And I would think that we'd know by now that the system ultimately doesn't work in the long run. But the problem, I think, is that the people behind the military-industrial complex aren't really concerned about the long run. Many corporate executives know expect that they're only going to have their job running General Dynamics or Raytheon or whatever it is for 4 or 5 years. And people in positions in the State Department, so on, many of them are replaced every 4 or 5 years. And so they're really looking at what can we do in the next 4 or 5 years and not worry so much about the long term. The Chinese, on the other hand, their leadership is very different, and they do very long-term planning. So they're looking at the conquest, if you want to call it that, and I think we could, of Africa from a very long-term perspective. We look at it from a much shorter-term perspective.
Clearly, we're witnessing a collapse of the middle class. 50% of American children are living in or at the threshold of poverty. Are we not, in principle, a developing third world nation in reality, but a wealthy developed nation only regarding a high gross domestic product? And explain the goal of economic imperialism that the U.S. and large corporations have exerted on poor developing nations in the past has now become part of our own domestic economic policies with the international and intentional goal to let the world know that Americans are going deeper into debt because our only truly thriving industry, which sucks up the majority of the gross domestic product, is military and intelligence.
Yeah. We are. One of the things I write about in the New Confessions of an Economic Hitman is that we developed this model during my time in what we call the third world or the developing countries, and it was so successful that now it's come home to roost here and to some degree in Europe also, in parts of Asia like Japan and places. So, yes, it has come home to roost. And I think what we're truly seeing is a very, very greedy and selfish ruling class, the corporatocracy, the ones who really pull the strings around the world, just getting richer and richer. I'm not sure what their end game is. I'm concerned that what's happening is we're becoming more and more robotized. Robots are taking over. Artificial intelligence, most experts believe, will be more intelligent than human beings within the next 20 years. They won't be as creative necessarily. It won't be able to perform some of the physical functions that humans perform, but it will be able to analyze situations very objectively, without emotions, without ego involvement, and figure out solutions that are better than any solutions we can figure out with all of our garbage attached to it. And that it may be that these ruling elites, the corporatocracy, is seeing basically most labor replaced by robots, and they'll have even more control over populations. Where they'll go with that is quite beyond the imagination, truthfully. I don't know where it's going. What I do know is that we ought to be aware of it, and you're making people aware of it. I'm making people aware of it. There are a lot of people out there making people aware of it, and figure out how to deal with this. So if the robots are coming, artificial intelligence is coming, we probably aren't going to stop it. How do we then, as human beings, relate to it and make sure that if they replace the menial, dumb task that so many people are doing? I mean, nobody goes to school to clean toilets in a hotel, I don't think. But a lot of people end up doing it. And if robots replace that, great. As long as those people that are removed from that job of cleaning toilets somehow get enough income to feed their families and give them good housing and clothes and a decent life. And maybe that'll free them up to do something more creative. That would be where we'd like to go. That's what I want to see happen. And the book I'm working on now goes into that in some detail, is how we get there, where we need to go. The other possibility, of course, is that we'll just become more and more enslaved to the very wealthy.
That's the answer I know is correct. I do not ascribe any spiritual, ethical, moral, humanistic values to those oligarchs or those in power. John, I'd like to finish up our program today by moving towards more of a spiritual issue, especially the crisis we face, because there's still a vacuum in the nation's ethics at a popular level. Now, though there seems to be evidence that this is changing, both corporate Democrat and corporate Republicans, and most notably this current White House, contains nothing that represents spiritual values. So could you give us your perspective on this issue, what you see we have to be doing, which direction we have to go, so that we can give some hope to the future, keeping in mind when Goldman Sachs was challenged once with increased federal oversight, they simply barked back they could just as easily move their operation to another country. And big pharma giant Pfizer has recently threatened to move its headquarters out of the United States. And Monsanto did the same several years ago. That is why we call these CEOs, presidents, and chairmen of banks and huge industrial firms transnationalist. They hold no fidelity to any nation and simply pursue a doctrine of global corporate Inc. above the laws of nations to engage in unhindered speculative investment in free trade and global profiteering. So since you are deeply involved in spiritual efforts in the United States and other nations, can you provide some spiritual insights and observations into what you believe the U.S. has become today?
Well, Gary, I'd like to do that with a metaphor because I think this may be the best. I am very hopeful that things can spread. So if you were coming from another solar system and you were in a UFO, what we call a UFO, looking down on the Earth from up above, you would see this beautiful blue-green planet with incredible abundant resources, and you'd see its most predominant lifestyle, the humans, brutalizing it and brutalizing each other, almost like bacteria that have gone crazy and are destroying their host and in the process destroying themselves. Or maybe, you know, like a virus. But you would see, if you look carefully, one place on this planet where there's something miraculous happening. And that's the area where I spent a lot of time, in the Amazon. When I first started going there in the late 60s, and even 20 years ago, these, what we call tribes, they're actually nations, the Shwa, the Achwa, the Kichwa, the Warani, the Zapata, they were all fighting each other. They were terrible enemies, and they were killing each other, and they were treating each other outlandishly. But you would see, if you were looking down for over the last 20 years or so from that UFO, that how now they've all come together. And the very tribes that were killing each other are intermarrying now, and they form these amazing federations. And they're doing that because they know that's the only way they're going to save their rainforest. If they come together and keep the oil companies out, and try to change the whole spiritual framework of their countries, Ecuador, Peru, Colombia, especially Ecuador is where it's really happening in a big, big way. And it's been very successful in keeping oil companies out. So you'd look down and you see this one place where these bacteria or these viruses are learning that they can't consume their host, that they've got to come together to save their host. Now, this is a metaphor, but I think it tells us a story that there is hope, that what you're doing, what I'm doing, what many people are doing who are writing about this, speaking out about it, making these movies that I mentioned earlier, are bringing to light the shadow. And as you said, the Trump administration is making it, is really showing us the shadow. And so I have great hope that if we keep talking about this, we will do what this small group of people in the Amazon have managed to do, and come together and understand that the Russians and the Chinese and the Brazilians and the Indians and the Americans and everybody else, we all live on a very, very fragile space station called Earth. There are no shuttles. We can't get off. Well, maybe a few of us will go to the moon or Mars or someplace, but that's not the answer. We need to take care of the space station. And we need to recognize that we are a bacteria or virus gone wild, and we're consuming our host, and therefore we're destroying ourselves. And so we need to spread that. And I believe it is happening. There's an awakening around the world. It's hard to see. I'm blessed that I get to travel to all these different conferences and meet with students and people from all walks of life around the world, and I see this awakening. So that brings me hope. And the fact that you and I are doing this show right now also brings me hope. And the fact that there's a lot of people who are going to hear this show and going to have to think more about this and probably go out and take some actions to further this, to expose the story beneath the story, that all brings me hope.
Good for you. I appreciate those insights. For all the people listening right now, the new book is The New Confessions of an Economic Hitman. My guest, John Perkins, at johnperkins.org, and well as dreamchange.org. John, thank you for being with us today.
You're welcome, Gary. And I'd also like to point out I'm a co-founder of Pachamama Lands, which I think a lot of your listeners probably know about. And I'd also like to encourage them to go to my website and actually put their name in the little box so that they get the newsletters. Thank you.
Okay. This has been a continuation of our conversation with Remarkable Minds, Progressive Commentary Hour. I'm Gary Null. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love. Don't need to escalate.